Welcome, 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 beloved listeners. And what will I call the program tonight? I think I've called it Late Night Love because I've got a couple of people I love on the program tonight. The lovely Laura Tingle will be joining us with a Canberra update, and then the very lovable George Gittoes will be coming on the program. He's won the Sydney Peace Prize, and we're going to top it up with a koala stamp, and we're also going to take a detour into the Indian Ocean where you will learn, as I have, the rather grim tidings that we're in the middle of what looks like a nuclear arms race right in the neighbourhood. But talking about love, first up I wish to wish my number four daughter, Rory, a happy birthday. Rory's 23 in just a wink of an eye, and it seems only a wink of an eye that she used to sit here on my lap when she was 2 years old and introduce the program. Heavens above, doesn't time fly? Anyway, Rory, or as I'm now required to call you, Aurora, a very, very happy birthday. Now let's talk to Laura. We're talking countdown to the federal budget, Laura. It's in a month's time. The latest poll numbers show that the pre-budget isn't looking all that bright for the government. Oh, and in another blow, business and energy groups are siding with Labor in regard to the renewable energy target. Laura, welcome back. Tell us all about it.
It's all going pretty well, Philip. I'm sure there's a cunning plan here somewhere. Yes, we've got a month tomorrow we'll have the federal budget, and I think the presumption you've got to make is still that the government really doesn't have any idea what its political and policy strategy is. That's partly they've got themselves into a bit of a political bind, of course, but things have got very, very complicated on the economy now. And I think that's going to make it really limits whatever you think of the government and its policies. It's a really tricky call to make this time around about what you actually can do on the budget without sort of upsetting the apple cart even more than it already is. So the Financial Review carried this very big interview, mostly in today's newspaper, in Monday's newspaper, should I say, with Joe Hockey. And he's saying that the iron ore price could be as low as $35 forecast in the budget. And this is from a peak of $120. And, of course, iron ore is one of our biggest exports. That gives you an idea of the continuing fall that fell under Labor as well. That means less revenue for the government. That means more pressure on the deficit. And while the coalition used to rail and carry on and hoot about Labor's incompetence about getting the budget back into surplus, Joe Hockey can't now say when the deficit will stop getting bigger. So it's all a bit, everybody's getting to enjoy the pain of being a government overseeing a budget that's not doing very well.
I take it you didn't have to try and see Joe Hockey's face through a cloud of expensive cigar smoke.
No. And, I mean, one thing, Philip, I would have to say in Joe Hockey's defence is that we very rarely get to sit down with politicians these days and just talk to them for an hour and a half, which we got to do on Friday. And when you do, you get to get a bit more of a feeling for, you know, whether they've got any idea what they're talking about, you know, why they think what they're thinking. You get out of the slogans and things. And he had a lot to say about a whole range of issues from the economy to budget policy to tax strategy. Not all of which a lot of people would agree with. Some people would agree with it, but at least you got some idea that he was thinking about it, which is vaguely encouraging.
But there's no changes to the tax policy thus far, despite the review.
Well, this is one of those classic things where the government's got itself in a bit of a bind, where it commissioned all these reviews and white papers on a wide range of subjects. One of them was tax. One of them is the federation and therefore how you split up the money with the states. And they're not destined to see the light of day for another few months. So, and the grand strategy was that these white papers would inform the policy the government took to the next election. But I don't think the government really understood how desperate things were on the budget. I think they just thought that Labor didn't have any idea what it was doing and that they'd just come in and it'd all be really fine and dandy. So they don't feel that they can do a lot on tax, though I think there will be a range of sort of smaller tax measures, if you like, or measures that don't sort of hit the average pay packet. You always talk about Google taxes, for example, and changes to the GST, which would mean things like Uber taxi services and Airbnb would come into the GST net, but they're not going to ramp up personal income tax, for example. But the problem is they also can't cut spending all that much more in the short term lest it undermine a fairly fragile level of economic activity which is underway at the moment.
This is Late Night Live and we're mingling with Tingle on matters regarding the budget. New polls out this morning, an interesting disparity between the news poll and the Fairfax poll. Get onto the party's ratings in a moment, but let's stick on Joe. Just like iron ore, his approval rating has plummeted 22 points and his disapproval rating has risen 23 to 58%. And yet at the same time, it seems that voters still trust the coalition with managing the economy.
This is the essential problem that Labor, it's had for however long. I mean, there was a brief period during the Hawke Keating years where Labor was able to turn that round. But I think there are a couple of things. We should mention that those figures for Joe Hockey are over quite an extended period of time. So we're looking at his ratings plummeting over a period of, I think, 12 months or so. So he's got a credibility problem without a doubt. I don't think that's been helped by the way the Prime Minister has played politics. I think he's been much too prepared to both sacrifice his treasurer and also leave his treasurer sort of dangling in the wind on a lot of occasions.
It's not just his treasurer though. That's a bit of a tray of Tony's.
It is. I think a lot of people within the coalition sort of see that the way it's worked is that anybody who looks like they might be a bit of a threat to the Prime Minister get some sort of treatment which ends up making them not look so good, shall we say. Be that as it may, on the question of economic management, I think the gap narrowed a little bit between Labor and the coalition, Philip, but let's be frank here. Labor is yet to really reposition itself on any policies of great substance. It had a couple of good forays into policy areas like multinational tax and has run the debate in the last few weeks on that. But
Second, if you don't mind, Laura, because that's...
Sure.
I want to do a segue into the other polling figures, but it's interesting that despite everything, 58%, according to the figures, still take returning to the budget very seriously. They rate it as a high priority.
I suppose I'm a little bit sceptical after all these years about some of these figures, Philip, because often a poll will have people saying... do you think that they should put taxes up and increase services rather than increasing services? And everybody says yes. But if you reframe the question to be, should your taxes go up, they say no. So I think people generally do have this sense that we should do something about the budget, but they're yet to be persuaded that whatever that is might actually hurt them.
Okay, I think that's a very... plausible response. Now let's look at the parties. Labor leads 54 to 46. Shorten's popularity has dropped, only slightly. Abbott's approval rating has risen, only slightly. But as you say, Labor hasn't really been able to make the enormous gains politically that the ongoing travails of Tony's government should have permitted, should have made inevitable.
Well, 54-46 is a respectable lead. I'd say that for a start. But certainly Shorten as an alternative to Tony Abbott has not made those huge inroads. And, of course, there's this great agitation within Labor now about what the right approach to this is. Do you come out? And it's not necessarily even a question of really specific policies, but do you try to come out and reposition yourself now, or do you wait till later? And I think my instinct is that there is this real push on for Labor to start that as soon as it thinks it's got a good platform, because there's this argument, well, if we come out with one policy or two policies, it just gets drowned out in all the noise. We have to really find a platform that where people are paying attention, and they think that that is probably the first one of those is the budget speech in reply. And you'll remember that the last few speeches in reply, excuse me, have been pretty bland affairs, particularly when Tony Abbott was opposition leader. He specialised in not actually having any alternative suggestions that anybody could remember in his budget speech in reply. It would just be rhetorical. And I think this is one of those occasions when people are really looking for some substance. And I think if Bill Shorten was actually able to make people stop and think about, and say, oh, this guy seems to have some ideas, whatever they might be, it would actually make a really big impact, because, you know, the sense that the government is floundering is just sort of so rampant, which comes out in things like Joe Hockey's approval ratings.
Laura, you have a very high approval rating on our little wireless program. Thank you very much. Laura, political editor of the Australian Financial Review. And now fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy ride as we have a nuclear arms race in the Indian Ocean. Bishop, who is one of the front benchers that has from time to time been cut off at the knees by her Prime Minister, she's off to talk to the Iranians this week about Iranian asylum seekers and, of course, issues to do with the nuclear program. And as we're all painfully aware, Barack Obama is having a sort of dance to the death with Republican recalcitrance and even a few on his own side of politics about Iran's atomic activities. But what we haven't heard much about is a potential case of nuclear proliferation that might be occurring very close to our shores. This month, Pakistan clinched an agreement with China to purchase no less than 8 submarines that could be easily equipped with nukes, while India will commission its own nuclear-powered sub towards the end of the year. Now, throw Beijing's fleet of vessels into the mix, and defence experts are warning of a potential nuclear arms race in the Indian Ocean. Now, to get a sense of where all this is going, to run a Geiger counter over it, I'm joined now by Dr. David Brewster. David's a specialist in South Asian and Indian Ocean strategic affairs with the ANU, and he's author of India's Ocean, the story of India's bid for regional leadership. And we're also joined by Nicholas Stewart. Nicholas is an author and columnist with the Canberra Times. He specialises in defence and strategic issues, and he's currently a press fellow at Wolfson College in Cambridge University. Gentlemen, welcome to our little wireless.
Good evening,
David, you argue that in the coming years, India, Pakistan, and perhaps even China will deploy a significant number of nuclear weapons in the Indian Ocean. This clearly entails major risks for regional security.
Yes, look, we're seeing a very unhealthy mix of unstable relationships, of nuclear relationships in the Indian Ocean, where several countries are pushing nuclear weapons into the maritime realm. And the most dangerous relationship there is between India and Pakistan, which...
Well, that's business as usual, isn't it? Because it's long been plagued by hostility and suspicion.
Yes, absolutely. It is absolutely business as usual, but the nuclearisation of the maritime realm, many people believe, creates much greater risks by lowering the nuclear threshold even further.
Well, David, the scale of the nuclear arsenals is impressive. Recent estimates have India having 110 nukes, while Pakistan has 120. How big are they?
Well, those numbers are a little bit out of date. The Indians are increasing their size of their nuclear arsenal, but the Pakistanis are working even more quickly, and they are believed to be headed towards the 200 mark.
And that's just since the program started.
That's right. I mean, it's... The important thing is to make a distinction between the type of nuclear weapon, between the tactical and the strategic. And the Pakistanis are busy miniaturizing their nuclear weapons and turning them into tactical weapons, placing them in the hands of local field commanders and quite soon potentially naval commanders. And the idea of that is to lower the nuclear threshold against India.
As you speak, I can feel the audience wishing we'd change the subject. Nicholas, how unstable are the bilateral ties at the moment?
Hi, Philip. David's absolutely right. I mean, the problem isn't that there's any extra degree of danger that has particularly taken place over the last month or the last couple of months. The worry is the underlying dynamic. It's just very unstable, and it could blow up quite significantly. I shouldn't have used the word blow up then. It could escalate quite rapidly. And the danger is, exactly as David points out, if command and control of nuclear weapons is devolved to minor commanders, there's a real danger there. They're just the other point is there isn't the transparency that has previously been the case in the confrontations between, for example, the US and the Soviet Union. At the moment, myself and three other journalists were invited over to Pakistan for the recent naval exercises there, the Exercise Oman, but that invitation was very suddenly cancelled. There just isn't an appreciation of how to build stability and transparency.
Well, Nicholas, as you point out, if they're being handed over to local commanders, there's just a chance that those local commanders can go a bit potty, or in fact hand them over to a third party.
Well, it's highly, it would take quite a lot to suggest that they'd be handed over to a third party. But of course, we all remember the Dr. Strangelove film. And, that
remember it. I regarded that as a great documentary.
Indeed. It's the nightmare scenario. And it's something that no one wants to have happen.
Okay, David, 5 years have passed since India launched its first nuclear-capable ballistic missile submarine. What steps has New Delhi taken since to upgrade its sea-based nuclear weapons capability?
Well, that vessel, the Arhant, was really launched as a technology demonstrator that they could build a nuclear ballistic missile submarine. And it's actually not becoming operational until probably later this year or sometime next year. But there's also a fleet of an additional 3 to 4 ballistic missile submarines that they've commenced to construct. And in addition, another fleet of nuclear-powered hunter-killer submarines, which will complement that. And the Indians are also talking about potentially placing short-range nuclear missiles on essentially patrol vessels.
Going back to the Dr. Strangelove era, there was always the odd theoretician that argues that nuclear mutual assured destruction was a stabilizing influence, and a theorist such as the late Kenneth Waltz might claim the acquisition of nukes for sea-based deployment by India and Pakistan could act as a stabilizing force in the relationship. What do you think, Nicholas?
I think it's true, but only up to a point. The more fingers there are on the triggers or near the triggers, the greater the potential danger is. And there's always the risk that someone might lose their grip. As well as that, let's remember, David's utterly correct to focus on the naval escalation. Because when you look, a couple of years ago, I was up at the Swat Valley on the border of Afghanistan, and the Pakistani military, the army, is just submerged with this internal fight that they've got up there. And so as a result of this, there isn't the degree of control, it seems to me.
That's what I was implying about third-party stuff. You know, it's often very difficult to know which side the Pakistani army is on at any given moment. David, India has a no-first-use policy, but you write that it's subject to a number of significant caveats.
Yes, it's a policy that sounds very good and very sort of righteous, but it's also a policy that's been evolving over the last decade or so. And with each pronouncement of the policy, there sort of appears some new caveats. So, for example, the Indians have said they'll only use nuclear weapons in retaliation against a nuclear attack against them. But then they also add, well, we'll also use nuclear weapons if there's a nuclear attack against Indian soldiers anywhere in the world, or a chemical attack or a biological attack. And they've also been potentially suggesting that the no first use policy only applies against states, and so potentially allowing them to use a nuclear weapon against non-state actors.
Well, Nicholas, this raises the fact that Pakistan more than hints at the possibility of deploying nukes, not only if they're subject to a military attack from India, but also if their economy was being strangled, or if they were blocked from accessing shared water resources.
I know, that's right. The key to deterrence is uncertainty, because it prevents rational calculation and one side pushing the other. But the problem is that there are just Pakistan really feels extremely nervous at the moment. It has never had a great deal of strategic depth, and there's always the danger that they're pushing the tripwire further and further forward. And at some state, quite accidentally, one or the other country may just move over and knock the tripwire off.
Late night love on RN doesn't seem to apply at the moment, because we're talking about a potential nuclear arms race in the Indian Ocean. Well, not so much potential as actual. My guest are Dr. David Brewster. David is visiting fellow with the ANU's Strategic and Defence Studies Centre. And Nicola Stewart is a columnist with the Canberra Times and press fellow at Wolfson College in Cambridge. David, Pakistan isn't India's only strategic adversary. What role might China play in this nuclearisation of the Indian Ocean?
Yes, well, China is another big element in this unstable mix, and many in Delhi regard China as India's real strategic rival rather than Pakistan. On top of that, China has a great nuclear advantage over India in terms of its coverage, missile coverage of the entire Indian subcontinent, whereas Indian missiles, because of their placement and their inferior technology, cannot currently destroy all of the cities in eastern China. And that is one of the key reasons for India developing a sea-based nuclear deterrent, so that potentially Indian submarines can be forward deployed either to the Bay of Bengal or even to the South China Sea, and from there target eastern China.
Okay, Nicholas, but China are playing both sides of it, because Pakistan's Prime Minister announced that Islamabad has reached a deal to purchase 8 subs that could be nuclear equipped. That must have ruffled a few feathers in New Delhi.
Yes, I mean this becomes a question of who's surrounding who. The argument is that Beijing is feeling threatened because it's being surrounded by an attempted coalition between Japan, America, Australia, and India. But equally, breaking out, if Beijing manages to develop specific links with Islamabad, it allows China to reach out, and it causes a degree of uncertainty in New Delhi, which is feeling that it's being surrounded. Where the problem is that we've got both sides attempting to escalate through mutually supportive security treaties with other countries. The worry is that this is driving, exactly as David says, an arms race.
David, India's land-based nuclear deterrent is not enough for them?
No, the range of the missiles and the geography means that land-based missiles from India can't reach eastern China, and whereas Chinese missiles can be placed in Tibet, and with their range they can cover the whole of India. So that's a key reason for India to develop a marine-based nuclear deterrent.
Nicholas, has Washington played a role in any of this, or are they planning to?
Oh, look, I think whether or not Washington actually has played a role, that's certainly the perception in Beijing. There are different elements jockeying for control at the moment, and now that while this continues, the military is certainly using the opportunity to emphasise their own power, and that goes for their Pakistani Navy as well. They're using this as a means of gaining greater recognition within the country, and there's a degree to which that's all working out. Internal arguments between different services are working out, but as well as that, you've also got this real feeling of paranoia that's being developed on both sides. You can also see from Washington's point of view, they're wondering why is China attempting to develop such a large navy? Why are they selling even these old, very noisy subs to the Pakistanis when Pakistan had previously been going to buy French submarines? There's just a great deal of uncertainty about.
Well, at least we've now got a couple of people who can manufacture submarines for Australia. You should get on the blower straight after the program. Gentlemen, I thank you very much for that. David Brewster, expert in South Asia and Indian Ocean Strategic Affairs, Senior Maritime Security Fellow at the Indian Council on Global Relations, and a visiting fellow with the Australian National University Strategic and Defence Studies Centre. Whew. And Nicholas Stewart, a contributor to the Canberra Times, whose columns focus on strategic and defence issues, and as I said, he's currently a press fellow at Wolfson College in Cambridge. And after a little bit of music, be upstanding for George Gittos. Well, the Nobel Peace Prize has been given to some extremely problematic people. Henry Kissinger comes to mind. But the Sydney Peace Prize, God, it's been good. I'm just looking through all the Sydney Peace Prizes since 1998. Terrific group of people, many of them friends of the program. In fact, all of them, every single one of them has been on the show. Let's just rattle some of them off. Mohamed Yunus in 1998, Desmond Tutu, Sanana Gusmao, Sir William Dean, my favourite Governor General, Mary Robinson, Anan Ashrawi, Arundhati Roy, Irene Khan, Hans Blix, he was terrific, Patrick Dodson, who else have we got here? John Pilger, Vandana Shiva, Noam Chomsky, and Julian Burnside last year, and sitting opposite me is this year's recipient, my old friend, George Gittos. And George, of course, has been on the program probably as much as any individual in the program's history, apart from Bruce Shapiro. Congratulations, son.
Thank you, Philip. It's just wonderful to be here.
And I'm going to give you a koala stamp as well, mate. Oh, so you're going to go away back to Afghanistan loaded down with goodies.
That's right. And we'll have a big cuddle as well, I think.
Yes, but that's off air. That's off air.
Yeah.
Were you surprised?
I was.
I mean, you're the first artist.
Well, I think that's what's important. I'm certainly not in the same league as any of the wonderful lists that you just mentioned, but the fact that they see artists as, you know, peace bringers, because, you know, we create, we don't destroy. Look at, I'm in mourning today over what's just happened at Nineveh. You know, the destruction of the greatest artworks on the planet. And what I can't understand is why they can take out a Taliban in a four-wheel drive car or a motorbike in Pakistan, and they can't take out a couple of bulldozers in Iraq, Philip.
Let me read the citation for your award, George. For exposing injustice for over 45 years as a humanist artist, activist and filmmaker. For his courage to witness and confront violence in the war zones of the world. For enlisting the arts to subdue aggression. And for enlivening the creative spirit to promote tolerance, respect and peace with justice. One could flip it over and say that you're a troublemaker, that because over the years I've been talking to you, you seem to me to be always involved in a war of one sort or another.
That's correct. I've just only just returned from Jalalabad, where our Yellow House is doing wonderfully.
I want to go through what it's up to since our last chat. Mm-hmm. But why did you go to all places on earth? Why did you take your ideas and your energies to Jalalabad?
Well, Bin Laden was there, and it's the place where this whole era started, and my life has been covering these movements in history, and it's still Talibanized, and it's a huge challenge. But really, it wasn't my decision. The people of Jalalabad asked me to come, the artists. You see, in Jalalabad, there's no art schools, there's no theatres, no galleries, nothing. And they heard about the work I was doing in Pakistan and said, please, George, we need you, come. And I established the Yellow House, and we've just seen so much progress. We've now got schools there for gifted children, and the children are making movies. I think the
Let's look at some of the achievements. Seven Pashtun films, including one by Afghanistan's first female director.
Yeah.
Establishment of a recording studio, edit suite, and cinema, where both men and women can sit without segregation. That in itself is an extraordinary achievement. The first women's workshop, film technology and funding, support from the Australian Embassy. Six radio programs, gosh, you make radio national look like pikers. Two mini documentaries by women, one nature video, one education video, on and on it goes.
Yeah, and one of the greatest things recently, we're mainly concerned these days for the children as well as the women. And when we first came to Jalalabad, you couldn't put up a billboard with human figures on it because of this restriction against representation. And we started putting up billboards advertising the films with our young actors on them. And then they finally put up a big electronic billboard like in Times Square. And it was just to advertise mosque times and, you know, preaching dates and things. And I decided that we were going to make a music video about the children of Afghanistan and their needs, and use a young singer. And we went up into an old Buddhist mountain, you know, and we made this thing. And the first night, all the kids were there and all the artists were there. And naturally, when it went up, we got the worst of the Taliban, and they came down on us, and they were screaming at me so much that my face was covered with their spit. And I just waited till they're finished, and I went over to the oldest, meanest one and gave him a hug and said, look, these are your kids. Don't you care about their future? You know the young guy that he's probably played at your children's wedding who wrote the music? This is yours. And the penny dropped, and I think it'd be pretty hard for anyone to stop us putting our music videos on anymore. But then, you know, that's the difference between artists and soldiers. Like if the Americans had made some video, no matter how good it may have been, and they put 100 soldiers there to defend it, there would have been a suicide bomber to blow it up. You know, like, we've worked through the community.
You're in the most Talibanized city imaginable. You're the only Westerner in the east of the country who doesn't live behind fences and barbed wire. You've told me the story before, but on this grand occasion, please tell me again.
Well, the Yellow House, we're in this street, and the local community love us. There's the local Malik is on our side, and while we're there this time talking about the Australian Embassy, they got a message that the Taliban were going to kidnap Helen and I and we should leave. And instead, Helen went to the Malik and the Mullah, and the whole community came behind us and said, we'll protect you. And that was many months ago. And the people just love us there. I'm Baba George.
Does Helen wear the burqa?
Sorry?
Does Helen wear
Helen the has to. She hates the burqa, but she walked out of the gate. Even though the people love her, she just got out of our street, she'd be stoned to death. You can't walk, a woman can't walk the streets of Jalalabad without a full burqa. And that said, she can still walk the streets of Jalalabad with everyone knowing who she is and what she represents. And with me, I can walk home at night on my own through this very, very dangerous city because...
The desecration of that ancient city, Nineveh, which is heartbreaking,
yes.
Of course, takes one back to the destruction of the giant Buddhas.
That's correct.
In Afghanistan, one of the great cultural atrocities. Mm-hmm. Did the Taliban learn anything from that?
The Taliban have learned a lot. In fact, Maulana Haqqani, who's the one Taliban who decided to risk his life and go in the election, regularly comes to the Yellow House, and... he's fighting a battle within his own organisation to get them to see the need for women's education and all of these other things. In fact, he's got 14 sons and some of them are coming to the Yellow House. And this is a Haqqani, you know, Haqqani network. And they're learning editing. And one son turned to me one day and said, you know, Baba, I don't agree with a single thing my father thinks. So there's a lot of hope, Philip.
You, of course, had a devastating experience in Rwanda.
That's correct. It's 20 years now since the Kibeho massacre. And there's a very, very moving thing happening on Wednesday. The photo I took of Jonathan Church carrying a young man, they've made a bronze sculpture of it, and the Army's now giving out 7 awards every year for soldiers... for ethics, not for courage in battle, but for courage in ethics. And that's called the Jonathan Church Award. And a beautiful thing about all this publicity...
We should point out that he was an SAS trooper.
He was an SAS trooper, and he and I and Paul Jordan teamed up to collect babies. But a beautiful thing that came out of all this publicity is the very, very courageous woman doctor that was there, Carol Vaughan Evans. I haven't spoken to her for over a decade, and I worry about her. And she... sent me a beautiful email as a result of the publicity for the Peace Prize. And she's okay. She's now in the Air Force.
Ellen Love on RN. And I'm talking to the lovable Australian artist, filmmaker, etc. And this year's Sydney Peace Prize winner, George Gittoes. George, when you think back on all the war zones and all the near misses and all the horrors that you've not only seen but then depicted in your paintings, what's the worst single experience?
Oh, absolutely, Rwanda. And I was a lot younger, that was 20 years ago then, and I felt that I had a duty to document every child that had been decapitated and every bit of horror that was there. And now, like, in the Yellow House, we had a suicide bombing nearby and the bombers' bodies were in the trees, and I just didn't want to go there. I just didn't want to focus my lens on it anymore. I had enough in Rwanda. But what I've learned is that you can do all that documentation, and my painting, The Preacher, that I did in from Rwanda, of the very brave preacher who gave people hope. But the thing that really works is to actually be there and to use your creative skills to make things happen, like the Yellow House. So in my old age, it's less about showing the horrors of war, but more about bringing the joys of art.
You know, I suddenly remember one of the most harrowing interviews ever on this program, and it was with the Canadian-born general who was in charge of the UN troops. Dallaire, and he had to sit back. He wasn't allowed under his terms of engagement to protest, you know, to try and stop anything. And he has been a psychological wreck ever since.
That's
the bloke
correct.
That came on the program was just terrible to talk to him. You, of course, can turn pain into art.
That's right. It's an
oyster.
It's a beautiful thing. And what I'd recommend, like everyone talks to me about post-traumatic stress, and you could do this too, Philip, is to, when you convert what you've experienced into writing, and that's turning it into a story, somehow or other that helps you. And I know that the soldiers who survived Cabo who have written about it, they'll all agree that writing about it. So in a way, I never stop writing. And it's kind of odd, you know, what you write about the experience, no matter how truthful it is, then the experience kind of becomes an artifact. And sometimes I'll be talking to a large audience and I'll be telling these stories and they're real, and a tear will run down my face because the reality breaks through the story. But writing stories is the best armor you've got against post-traumatic stress.
I've met some of your Yellow House graduates from Afghanistan, and you've certainly transformed their lives.
Yeah, the miracle that's happening, particularly now we're working with the children, the biggest problem for Afghanistan is that with all these years of war, that a lot of the children haven't gone to school, and now they're starting school, they're 12 and 13 and 14 and too old to begin with young kids. So we've created like a school at the Yellow House which prepares older kids to be able to go in, and they've already know how to read and write, so they can start a few grades up. And we found the most talented amongst them, and I'm enormously proud. They're all going to school today and they want to be artists and writers. And one of the last things I did before I left, I let our kids interview suicide bombers. There's actually a jail in Jalalabad for failed child suicide bombers, the saddest place in the world. And most of these kids were kidnapped and then they were brainwashed, and they were told that the people that are killing were infidels, and in a few cases they suddenly realised they're killing other Muslims, so they went and pulled open their vest and usually weren't believed until they showed the vest. And my kids interviewed them, and it was just a very beautiful and moving experience that you realise that it's lack of education that enables this kind of brainwashing. And also, just before...
That's true in any culture, isn't
it? Yeah, but just before I left, I had a strange experience. My friend, the Haqqani, who's going for election, brought another Haqqani along and more or less arrested me and took me to their compound on the edge of the city. I thought, well, this is the night George Giddos loses his head. And I felt that maybe this is an exercise in proving to the good Haqqani that he's got a bad companion in me. And so I said, Haqqani, you're the richest man in the world. You've got 14 beautiful sons. I'd love to see you with all of them. And the boys came in and they each did a eulogy to George Giddos and gave me beautiful cakes and sweet tea and everything.
Yeah.
And then the bad ones stood up and said, we have to apologize. We had a very, very bad plan for you. And I was able to criticize them about using, you know, kids for suicide bombings and these sort of things, and they took it, and I survived the evening.
Tell us about this young bloke. He's 9 or 11.
Oh, yeah.
Who's a gangster and a genius.
He's a gangster and a genius. That's Steele Pooler. And this current film is about the kids of Jalalabad. And there's one child, he's 9 or 11, I'm not sure, and he controls all lower-level organised crime in that city. He's famous for taking out policemen. And this is a city where we've also filmed a 5-year-old girl who talks about when she was a child, who looks after her younger brothers and sisters and collects the cans and things that feeds them. And Pula carries a razor blade in his mouth, and so he's never without a weapon. And it was like being able to see a miniature Hitler. He's a complete sociopath. And yet, when I'd cross the road, he's little-handed going to mine and get me across the road to make sure I was safe. I started to think he was a monster because I kept on seeing his victims, other children who had nothing, who he'd taken all their money from them. And then I discovered one day that he was in love with this beautiful young girl, she's only about 11, called Shazia. And he wanted to give me a surprise and Shazia a surprise, so he took us along the banks of the Kabul River, and we came to this huge mansion. It was like something out of Barbaria, and it turned out that it was the richest man in Jalalabad who's the Minister for Customs, the guy that controls the border with the opium. And he pointed it and he said, Shazia, it's all about this. Someday this house is going to be yours and the gangs won't be allowed inside.
He's got a razor blade in his mouth, so mm-hmm. he's always got a weapon. You've got guns all over the place. Now, I'm going to ask a silly question because I know you've got a great answer. Mm. How come the recipient of the Sydney Peace Prize packs a lot of heat?
Well, that's just journalists visiting us. They're really only props. None of our shotguns work. They're all jammed up because I never learned how to use guns. We're given an alternative. At one point, the local police said, either you get full-time security guards with big AK-47s or you have guns. So we went out and bought the cheapest Chinese-made shotguns in the city.
Really crap guns.
Yeah, and we got them leaning up against the wall, and believe me, they're all seized up. But that was our only way of getting police permission for us to keep the Yellow House running.
I've turned the mic off. Tell us about Snow Monkey.
Well, Snow Monkey, the kids who sell ice cream in Jalalabad call themselves Wari Shanu, which means Snow Monkey. And refrigeration's non-existence in the city, so it's a miracle on a hot day to get an ice cream. And we were making a very, very serious movie. And every time we try to do an interview with someone like Akani, there'd be this horrible tune, happy birthday to you. And so I went out and tried to pay these kids to go away, and they wouldn't go away. And finally they took over the movie, and now they end up making their own drama called Snow Monkey, and they're the little snow monkeys.
I was glad to hear you sticking up for our mutual friend Julian Assange.
Ah, yes. Well, he's your biggest fan. He's listening tonight.
Is he? Well, I'm glad to hear that, because the poor bastard's been holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy, which, as both of us know, ain't palatial.
No.
He's been there for over 2 years. Tell us about your meeting with him. How is he?
Well, one of the first things he said, Philip, was that you are his link with Australia. He never misses you. He listens to this show. And he described himself, he said, a lot of people think they're edge walkers, but I'm a real edge walker. The building itself, there's two big police vans out the front with all sorts of electronic equipment. They've actually got a policeman in the
hallway between the two embassies, because people forget that or they don't know.
And Julian's angry with you if you actually give these people their names. And then he takes you to a window and shows you more there. And there's others with telescopes and things in Harrods. And
it's costing the British government squillions to do
absolutely.
It. Absolutely. It's just such a bloody nonsense.
So we went out and got him sushi from Harrods and... And he came out, he's adorable, he came up with all these half-empty bottles of various forms of alcohol, and we sat on the floor and we had a bit of a party on the carpet. And, I think...
But they've done such a demolition job on Julian.
Oh, yeah.
And, internationally, he's copped so much crap.
I don't believe anything Someday he'll be seen like we all look at our great legendary Ned Kelly, but there's never been any Australian as game as Julian Assange.
What's next for you, George? What are you up to?
Well, obviously,
500 things.
Yeah, keeping the Yellow House going. I'm writing a book called Blood Mystic, and
you're writing a book?
Yeah, I'm writing. Well, I've written it. I've just got to correct the spelling. So you'll be the first to get the copy of that.
Is it illustrated? Seriously, I presume it is.
No, no, it's not.
No, just text.
Pan Macmillan wanted me to do an autobiography, and that would be impossible. I'd spent the rest of my life trying to put it together in my memory shot.
Well, no one would believe it anyway.
No, it's unbelievable. And so I did dispatches. I for the first time, I kept a proper diary throughout this period and sent it to them, and now we're just putting it together as a book.
What about Syria? I heard that you might be going there.
Yeah, well, I want to go to Syria, and like I've done a lot, as you know, I've done a huge amount of work in soundtrack to war and everything in Baghdad, and I feel that people who do understand what's going on there should be there and acting as a bridge. I was looking at a painting of mine yesterday called Civil War that I did in 2003, where it was clear that if the Americans came in and they created a government like Maliki's, which was fully Shia, that you'd end up with a civil war, and that's what you've got. And the media doesn't cover the fact that the Shia militias are killing Sunnis everywhere, that most of the supporters for IS are not actually IS, they're just local Sunnis trying to survive. And so I've got a network of people there. I could probably even almost certainly get in and talk to ISIL. And I think I've got a duty to do that. That's what I do.
You've seen a lot of death. You put yourself in harm's way. Do you fear it?
No, I don't think I do. I think that's where the Blood Mystic side comes in, Philip. Yeah.
George, lovely to see you. As I said, congratulations yet again, and please accept this, well, it's a hypothetical koala stamp, and it's wonderful to have you back. This year's award-winning Sydney Peace Prizer, George Gittoes, and that's your lot. On our next, Bruce Shapiro is back, and we have an assessment of the life and legacy of Singapore's Lee Kuan Yew with two long-time observers, and David Bradbury is going to tell us about his new film, The Crater. It's a dark story, and particularly sad story about Vietnam. That's a wrap. Stick around for the news, and I'm going to have a hug with George, and we'll see you later.